What I would try to do is to describe this observational program. This would be an observational talks. An observation program whose goal or hope, I should say, was to provide, has been to provide useful data for constraining models that, you know, in some extent we have been talking about, models dealing with both cold variants, I mean variants in general in distant clusters, but both cold variants, so galaxy evolution models, and the hot component of these variants, which is the intercluster medium that we see, as we show, hot out to, you know, at least ratio 1.3 or so. And not only that, but also the aim of this program was to provide, to have a multi-wavelength coverage of these clusters, as you can see here with all these observatories that I've used for this talk, so that we could study at the same time both the cold phase and the hot phase in clusters at high ratio. This is because, I mean, so far people have been studying, you know, there are X-ray people who do ICM, there are galaxy people who do galaxy evolution, and also from the theoretical point of view, we know that how hard it is to have a self-consistent model that treats the cold and hot phase simultaneously. So the hope here was to really try to find the elements which we can link the hot and the cold phase. We know that the hot phase is definitely affected by galaxy evolution. Galaxy evolution leaves, you know, some indelible stamp on the physical properties on the intercluster medium, and so that was the goal of these observations. So these are my collaborators, and a special thank goes to the GTO team for the ACS instrument on HST, which a lot of these data rely on, and you see there obviously VLT also for ground-based, and Spitzer data coming, and there is Chandra. So very quickly, I mean, the reason why, you know, one looks at, see, one is really, if one is interested in variance and three is trying to understand how variance form and evolve, I mean, it's a good idea to look at clusters. Why? I mean, we all know this, and just to remind that at redshift zero, we actually don't see most of the variance, as we know. In a high redshift, we do see them through the Lyman alpha, but at redshift zero, most of them are in this, are really escape detection on this warm medium that we haven't detected. It's very hard to detect, and only a small fraction is in galaxies, perhaps 10%, and also a pretty small fraction is in hot gas. So, and this is, say, in the field. Now, in clusters, I mean, we do believe that the baryon fraction is the same, you know, this 15% or so. However, the phase of these baryons in clusters is completely different. So, in clusters, say about 70% of the baryons are in this hot phase. We can readily detect in X-ray, and perhaps there are very little, if not negligible, warm baryons in clusters. And there is, you know, the usual 10% of galaxies. So if one, you know, wants to really study baryons, it's a good way, it's a good idea to look at clusters, because you can just see them, most of them. And so the key question, obviously, that one has in mind, are one, you know, one embarks on this sort of multi-wavelength programs, is, you know, when most of the stellar mass was assembled in galaxy clusters, and when the, you know, the first clusters form, and namely when the hot phase, when clusters lead up in the X-rays in a way. And so, and when, say, most of the thermalization in galaxy clusters occurred. And also questions like, okay, when the preheating, we know that there must have been some preheating just looking at the physical properties of the ICM at higher ratios. So when this preheating occurred and how, you know, occurred, and especially when the metals got dumped into the the intercostal medium. This is all question one has in mind. So one wants to try to solve, to address these questions. One of the key things is obviously moving to higher redshift. You know, you want to have large loopback times so that you approach the apical formation, and there is some hope to actually see evolution in the properties of the cold and hot variants. And also because the larger is the loopback time, as we know, the stronger is the constraint on the models. And then, as I said, you want to really go from X-ray down to UV rest frame, near infrared rest frame, so that you can really try to look at all the variants and their phases. And well, obviously, one would like to measure masses, because it's always better to deal with masses than with luminosities. You know, luminosities are big mass, they're affected by details of the star formation. Mass is something that grows, you know, in a way that we think we understand. And obviously, you need a model that, this is up to you guys, to really deal self-consistently between hot and cold phase. So basically, so the reason why I'll be talking about redshift 1 or redshift greater than 1 classes is because you will see that that's definitely looking at the intercluster medium properties of these clusters at high redshift. There is really a hope to see the production of the entropy that we see today in low redshift clusters, all this energy that has to be injected into the ICM. And most importantly, we just will be dealing with massive galaxies. And we know that, you know, the reason why people are studying massive galaxies as opposed to low mass galaxies is because those are the ones, you know, for which we have this prediction from the RQM models that should be forming later on, according to, you know, just the naive picture of CDM hierarchical base models. And so only looking, measuring the spectrophotometric properties of these massive galaxies, that actually we can really make some progress in discriminating between models. So, and so what I'll be showing is some of these. So what are the tools that we use, or the observables, if you want, that we use to constrain models? Well, I'll show you that for the cold phase for the galaxies, it's basically, you know, it's the usual spectrophotometry and light diagnostics that comes from these distant galaxies. Hopefully. On a very large wavelength range. And then the rest sequence of early types is a very powerful way of probing the age and the mode and the epoch of formation of cluster galaxies. And then obviously luminosity functions and stellar mass function, mass to light ratios. And you compare all these things, as we know. Once we don't know how to do it, we use the semi-analytical models, and hopefully driven by what we understand from hydro simulations. And there is stellar synthesis models that heavily go into this business. For the intergalactic medium, I won't have the time, I won't talk about the scaling relations, which actually are the, as we were discussing today at coffee, are the best, the strongest, the best tool to really probe things like entropy production, and so probe the way the galaxy formation has left its imprint into the intergalactic medium. And then there is the gas metallicity. That instead I will address today, because I won't talk about the dark matter, although I will show how we can actually even probe the dark matter distribution of this very distant cluster with the best ACS data we have today. So just visually, you know, to have some pretty pictures first always helps. This is a cluster, you know, what is supposed to be a massive altogether 10 to the 15 solar masses, merging cluster with two major clumps. And here you see the X-ray smooth. Actually, there is an extra X-ray blob here that you can see because the cut has been, it wasn't proper here. And the you know, the galaxy distribution, you see all the red galaxies belonging to the cluster. Now, these days, you can actually observe. So again, this is, you know, the Chandra contours on the top of a Eris, Keck Eris image. And so these days you can actually do amazing things with this. Yes, because with very short, with a few orbits, you can really go into the cores of these clusters, and you discover, you know, amazing patterns of arcs. And so you can use, you see this beautiful, you know, textbook example of a folded caustic through a galaxy. You can really use these multiple images to constrain the slope of this inner quartz. And so you can then, you know, compare the mass. In this case, this comes from the weak lens. You can imagine how you know, strong the weak lens and signals from the cluster is from the ACS data. You can, you know, compare the mass with these Y contours derived from the weak lens analysis with the Chandra X-ray mass. You can do the same, you know, compare the mass with the light, and you see that, you know, you have this is we'll see this through the talk. Generally, this already at this redshift, but even at redshift 1.3, we will see there is already the baryons map each other very well, and the baryons map the dark matter distribution very well. So already, you know, means that there's been already enough time for both the dark matter and the baryonic components to relax into the potential well. So these systems, you know, believe it or not, are quite dynamically advanced, and so the light tends to trace the mass more closely, and the gas instead is more diffuse, is more lumpy, less lumpy, sorry. So here I show you the best example today of how we can really probe the physical properties of the ICM. So we start at 35, right? 40, something, okay. Okay, how we can really derive the ICM physical properties with Chandra at the largest loop back time we can achieve today. So this is a Chandra field, 188 kiloseconds as it says. This was discovered, a cluster was previously discovered in the ROSA Deep Cluster Survey that I did several years ago. And so it's one of the four redshift gradient one clusters known today. And there was this very deep Chandra pointing on these clusters. And you see that this is adaptively smooth, by the way. Most of these things, you know, are AGN. And you see that there is a nice, we immediately saw a very positive feature in the X-ray surface baryon distribution, namely this edge here that you better see, you know, once you do the contours. So underneath is a coral picture coming from a combination of ACS and ISAC VLT images. So you see all the cluster galaxies, all these yellow things. So, and just to tell, well, we'll come back to this picture later, but, and you see this compression of the isopodes here, meaning that there is an edge in the surface binding distribution. Now, this edge could be either a cold front or a shock. We don't really believe. For these masses, perhaps more a cold front, meaning that this would be a sort of a subclump plowing through the cluster potential well, and, you know, plying through a hotter atmosphere. So this would be hotter here and colder here. Unfortunately, we don't have enough counts to really measure a jump in the pressure or a jump in the temperature, which would tell us whether this is really a shock or a cold front. But, you know, this is sort of, in a way, sort of resembles this famous example of the bullet cluster at low redshift that's been studied in great detail by Markovich. So in a way, you know, we can study now in more detail the distribution of the baryons. You see again the sharp edge here, and also we can, as I show you in a second, we can also compare the distribution of these baryons with the one from the dark matter and the one from the stars, which, you know, they're pretty well traced by the K-band light. Today, actually, we also have a K-band res frame, which from Spitzer, which can be used very effectively to trace the stellar mass, these systems. And then, you know, you can look at you can do some X-ray spectroscopy, and this was the first example where an iron line was easily detected at such a redshift. You know, you can then use the detection of this iron line beautifully to derive the metallicity, and, you know, all the other parameters that you derive on the gas, the mass of the gas, the obviously the total mass and so on. You know, you end up discovering that this is a typical sort of M star cluster at redshift 1.2, knowing a little bit of.
I'm sorry, redshift 1 or that's 1.0?
And no, a redshift 1, because we more or less.
Star correspondence.
Right, so we know more or less how the mass function evolves, and so when you plug that in, you discover this is pretty close to M star within a factor of 2, to be honest. And so I think this is I want to show this because it's relatively recent. The paper is almost accepted, but I think this really shows what you can do these days with ACS. This was a deep image with ACS, sort of 24 orbits in Z band and 12 orbits in I band. You can use these images to really try to see whether you see any weak lensing signal. Well, there is a very strong six sigma detection of the mass on this system, and so again, this is the derived mass distribution from the weak lenses amount analysis. See, these are 2 megaparsec, and then you can look at the mass profile. In this case, the community mass profile, and these are the weak lensing derived mass profiles for 2 assumption of the underlying mass function mass profile. So an NFW or non-synchronous thermosphere, and then you compare it with the X-ray mass. They actually, I haven't shown it here, but you know, you can get a better mass, a better estimate on the mass, combining the Chandra and the XMM data, because XMM has a pretty bad resolution, but it provides a lot of photons. So combine the 2 things, you have a decent, you know, 20% error bar measurement of the temperature, and hence the mass, and you see that the agreement is pretty good. Perhaps there is, well, this is, I don't want to go into the detail of this, but the agreement is pretty good, say. And then, okay, so we're doing this on the other 3 redshift greater than 1 clusters that we know. And again, you know, every time you see this mapping, very close mapping between the hot gas and the galaxies. Now, something I want to show, which I think it's an interesting measurement that has been described in a paper by Paolo Tozzi a year ago and collaborators. So what we did here is we used a sample of 20 at that time, now it's even more, 20 clusters. We just basically stuck together the X-ray spectra with the aim of having an average measurement of the iron abundance, you know, in these intercrustal media. So this is a fair average of the iron abundance averaged, you know, over a large volume of space where these clusters are scattered. And so you have a pretty good detection of the iron line and measurement on the underlying abundance. And you see that, you know, the surprise was, it's a bit boring perhaps, you know, but definitely the surprise was that the auto redshift 1.2, this is the green thing here, is the best measurement we have today, including the 4 clusters plus XMM data, is pretty flat. Okay, so this wasn't trivial, I would say, before we did this. So if the metallicity is the same as in local clusters today, it means that, you know, the most of the ICM enrichment must have been pretty much completed by, say, you know, redshift 1.2 plus a crossing time. So a crossing time is more or less a giga year. And so you end up with, you know, with a number of redshift 2. So by redshift 2, most of the enrichment must have been completed to have this scenario here. And then you also have to say that in order to have all these metals already 60% sent back on the loop back time, you must, as we know these days, you know, this is very considerable. You must have a lot of star formation high redshift in massive systems, and then you have to have a very fast and efficient mechanism to circulate these metals through the ICM. And this is.
Sorry, was that the blue
point? You ask. I wanted to raise them. Okay, this point is actually, this is an attempt of separating the hot systems. These are, so these red points are clusters hotter than 4 kV, and these are cooler than 4 kV. Now, the reason why I want to sort of not talk about this, because we're not, as we said in the paper, we're still not convinced. Well, you see other error bars, but it would be interesting to see that actually there is a temperature, there is an dependence of the metallicity on the temperature of these clusters. But I don't think we are in the position to still make this claim. So, but in the future we will address this point more carefully. And so now I will turn into the say the cold variance. So what we can really say, we haven't said anything what we can actually learn from the from using these Chandra measurements on the hierarchy cluster from the for the scaling relations. But what you derive is basically that the scaling relations evolve very little, and so obviously they depart from self-similarity as we knew already at lower redshift. So this is all consistent with having an increase of entropy in a way at pretty high redshift. So operating a pretty high redshift, that then we know entropy that we find, an excess of entropy that we find today in low redshift groups or in the cores of clusters. But this is something that I don't want to linger on too long. So instead, I want to turn into the what can learn on galaxy evolution and formation from this observation. So this is a combination of ACS and ISAAC. So 4 arc minutes, very deep ACS, very deep ISAAC, like 20 hours in JNK. So you combine these images, so you have very nice images, first of all, but also you have very nice data, as we'll show you later on. So this is that was 4 arc minutes, so 2 megaparsec. This is 1 megaparsec around the cluster. This is half megaparsec, just to tell you, and there are no observers here, but, you know, just to tell you that these two, well, there are actually, there are observers here. These two galaxies are 0.6 arcsecond apart, just to tell you, you know, how good these ACS and ISAAC images are. So you can really do a very good job and measuring the spectrophotometric properties and, of course, the morphology of this. You're going further in, sort of 200 kiloparsec. So there are also some beautiful strong lensing features that we are still studying. And then you can, you know, look at the morphology and look at the spectrophotometry of this. Here you just separate the early type spectra, so spectra that don't have any detectable O2, with the spectra instead that they do have an O2, so star forming galaxies, if you want, you know. Well, this is morphology, so you can talk about morphology for hours, but it's something that I won't address further here. But you see that there are already these massive spheroids. I can tell you they're spheroids when you fit Searcy profiles. And you know, for star forming population instead, there is already a hint of spiral arms here, this redshift. You know, as you expect, except in some cases like this one, you expect, you know, there are disturbed morphology, and there are also some red objects. This was red in the red sequence, so it puzzled me for a long time until we discovered it was an AGN2, so it's obscured. These are the CDs, but actually this is the broader cluster member, which is just a bit off. But so these are the two CDs in the center, and this is maybe sort of half arc minute away from the center, and it's brighter than each of the CDs, not of the sum of the two. So there is plenty of spectroscopy coming from VLT. There are, you know, now 38 cluster members, in fact. You can look at the distribution of this. You know, this is all useful for what I will tell you in a second about when we get into the numbers. You know, you have what you would expect in a way. The star forming galaxies avoid the center. There is no sort of obvious kinematical segregation, as you see here. The blue and the red things are sort of all over the places. So. So the first thing we did is to look at the red sequence. Now with ACS, you just, you know, run subtract or do this stupid plot, and you get this amazing detection of the red sequence down to, you know, 27 magnitude or so. So if you did this with ground-based data, this would be a big, you know, it wouldn't be so easily detected. This whole sequence would be blurred by the photometric errors. So we looked into this very carefully with this paper by John Blasier, there are another paper by Chris and myself, and so we measure, you know, thanks to the ACS data, of course, we were able to measure very accurately the intrinsic scatter. Here the error bars are very small, so the intrinsic scatter of this red sequence, having in mind, of course, that the scatter of the red sequence is a very good indicator of the age and possibly metallicity spread of the underlying stellar population. So the big surprise was that, obviously there is this evolution, which is a passive evolution, it turns out, from the normalization that you get from low Reshid clusters. But apart from that, the surprise was the spread, the scatter, was basically the same as in local clusters. You know, if you look at papers on like Kaufman et al. Paper in 1999, everybody was expecting this rest sequence to sort of disperse and by redshift 1, because, you know, by the time we should have been approached the epoch of the galaxy formation, but this is not the case. So even the infrared, you get to say this is a completely independent measurement done with infrared colors from the ISAC deep data. You see, you get exactly the same answer, which is the scatter and the slope of the rest sequence is similar to low redshift clusters. So basically, it's remained frozen over 65% of loopback time. And this, I think, was a bit of a surprise.
But how is this cluster selected?
X-ray.
So this is an X-ray detected cluster.
Yeah.
And then all the obstacles.
Right. So these are all real clusters. So.
Yeah. I just was wondering if it was a red sequence detected cluster.
No. Absolutely not. I think there's another way to go on this. For this kind of analysis.
Yeah.
Or is it the way to go for other things? And so the other observable, the other tool that we think it's important to use at this redshift was the luminosity function, the K-band. Since we had this extremely deep ISAC data, we could go 3 micrometers below L-star for the first time at this redshift. And since we have, you know, this huge multi-wavelength data set, we can actually do photometric redshifts very accurately. We can check them across, you know, 250 spectroscopic redshifts we are in the field. So we are in a pretty good position to actually derive the luminosity function accurately, and also the faint end without, you know, dangerous sky subtraction issues. I mean, there are also here, but we are able to handle it. So the reason why we were so excited about the luminosity function is because the K-band luminosity function, in a way, it should be very a sensitive probe of the formation redshift and the mass assembly history, right? Because you should be very sensitive to the epoch and the efficiency of merging, because this should affect the slope, the normalization, the shape of the luminosity function. And so this was has been the result. This is a paper by Toft et al. Already out for several months. And so this is the K-band luminosity function, so Z-band rest frame. The first thing we did, of course, we compared it with the Sloan stuff, you know, stuff that Michael has been doing as well. This is the latest Popeso et al. Measurement. And so here, what we found interesting was the fact that you see that sort of the bright end, actually 1.2, yeah, it got brighter. And again, this is passive evolution, if you throw that in. But the interesting thing is, you know, the most massive galaxy are already there with the same shape, redshift 1.2, and the slope. Now there are big error bars, especially in the slope measurements. But the slope, if anything, didn't get steeper. I mean, it might even so. It's, you see that, if anything, in fact, it got shallower. So this is a bit surprising, because you would think, you know, if you were in an epoch probing an epoch where merging was very efficient, you know, you would have to witness galaxies massive galaxy breaking into their lower mass progenitors. And so this is something that he doesn't seem to occur. So with the way we interpret these results is that these low mass galaxies are acquired from the field later on, say from redshift 1 to 0. But you have to push the epoch of merging, the efficiency of merging, to pretty high redshift in order to explain this result. So this would go here, a K20. The first star forming galaxy would start coming into here, K21. So I haven't said that, but I mean, this was a K-band selected sample for the spectroscopy. So we were very careful at not introducing selection effects. But you know, life is hard, redshift 1.2. So actually, star forming galaxy are only here.
And you take everything down to 21?
No, 21, and then there is, we go further, we went fainter just with a background subtraction based on the photometric redshift that I briefly described. So, I mean...
for things brighter than that, is there any color cut, or you just take everything in the field?
every in the field, you just don't take spectral things that have R minus K of, you know, bluer than 3, which is very blue to be anything. So we have, even the most star-forming galaxies are, you know, redder than R minus K of 3. So there was a little bit of, I mean, there was a color cut not to take spectra of, you know, of Tyson redshift 0.7 thing. So. And so that I think this I believe is a useful constraint for models. I think people haven't really used this for modeling and for constraining certain analytical models, for example. But I think this is a useful constraint also because the very similar situation, as we know, happens in the field. I mean, in the field there is a very there is a little evolution of the K band luminosity function for redshift 1.2 to 0, for example, for the K20 survey. And so, okay, and then, you know, you can, what you can do, already for the rest sequence normalization and slope, we have a pretty good indication of what the formation epoch should be, but then you can use for spectral photometry. And interesting, you find that these apparently, these very red spheroids do have, the brightest ones, they do have some H delta here. So they're red and everything. But they do have some Barman lines, like in this case H delta, the only one you can probe. And so once you model this with Bruch-Archer law and so on and so forth, you have to invoke obviously a post-star burst population of 1 gigahertz or so to leave this imprint. And so it's true that the stellar population, most of the stars form a redshift between 2 and 3 as we derive from the spectrophotometry and the red sequence, also from the fundamental plane that perhaps I will have the time to show. But there is also some drizzling star formation going on down to redshift 1.5 in the most massive and luminous galaxies. So even the most massive galaxies do have some young stellar population. So this is the first sign. Was the first sign that we are seeing the first signature that we're approaching the epoch of formation, so it's not as boring as, you know, look at the beginning. How long do I have, sir?
5 minutes more.
Okay. So this was a fundamental plane study. This is a very recent paper that Brad Holden is almost accepted, and that we did as a follow-up of these ACS observations. And so the with very deep, high-resolution VLT spectra, the velocity dispersion, the masses of these, of the brighter, of the four brightest cluster members were measured, and these are these black points here. And the stars, actually, the previous measurements by Van Dokkum et al. In another cluster which I showed at the beginning, at redshift 1.27 in the Lynx field. And so, for the first time, we sort of have a good, decent data set. There are, you know, they're not 2 data points, but they're 6 or something. To compare, for example, first of all, to measure the evolution of the fundamental plane, and again, it does fit this very smooth evolution that Peter van Dokkum found in the first study, which leads to a formation epoch again between redshift 2 and 3 of the stellar population once you take into account the progenitor bias and so on and so forth. But then, you know, you see that the mass to light ratio versus mass, you see, it's steeper here, but actually, once you factor in the obvious selection effect to the fact that this is a luminosity, it's a flux-limited sample, this is telling you, when you compare this with local clusters, this is a redshift 0, this is a redshift 0.4 cluster, these squares here. And when you compare, you see that basically what is happening there is the scatter of this relation is increasing, and we interpret this again as the fact that we're approaching the epoch of formation, and so the mass-to-light ratio has a larger scatter because luminosity has been affected by recent history, star formation history features. And then, you know, what you can do, you can measure the stellar masses, of course. We are doing this in two ways. One is using this large wavelength data set, I mean, the multi-wavelength data set from the B band out to the K band, but also with recent Spitzer data, which I will show here, but we don't have the numbers. I mean, we're not sure about the numbers yet. But I mean, with the Spitzer data, that's the good deal. With the IREC data, at 3.6 and 5 microns, you can actually measure, directly probe the K band rest frame and directly use the mass, stellar mass H band or K band correlation to estimate the stellar masses. And this way, we just did it with SAD fitting. So the red are the 1252, so these cluster saturation 1.2 spectroscopically confirmed early types. What we want you to do here is to compare this distribution of masses and ages with the early types, similar early types in the field, meaning early types of the same color and similar luminosities. And these are taken from the goods, obviously, which has a comparable high-quality data set. So the blacks are the goods galaxies at ratio 1.2 plus or minus 0.2, k-corrected to ratio 1.2 as the clusters. And you see that, you know, we're still working on this. There is no paper on this. But now I feel quite confident that something interesting is going on. It's the fact that, you know, a long-standing prediction, as we know of hierarchical models, is that early type galaxies in the field should be younger, right, than those in clusters, just because the evolution goes in an accelerated way into dense environments. And this doesn't seem to be the same, the case. I mean, the distribution seems to be pretty similar. I'm still, you know, trying to understand what this let's call them outliers are. I mean, just to give you an idea, these are in the goods field. So these are red, you know, galaxies again into this controlled sample that I used. Just to tell you that, you know, the very red bulges, but in some cases they're puzzling red disks around these galaxies. But the first result we had is the distribution of masses, stellar masses, and ages are not very different, which is a bit surprising. So, okay, I don't have to tell you that there are difficulties in standard models. And, you know, basically because it's pretty much, you know, pretty much as we know based on phenomenology as opposed to a real theory, which, you know, underlines the difficulty of knowing how the variance evolve. And so, you know, as we know, I think it was Joe Silke was the first brave one I heard, you know, that now, I mean, everybody knows that the dark matter hierarchy must be inverted, but, you know, I remember...
Just not only to the variance.
Yeah.
The dark
matter,
isn't it? Dark
matter?
Say the
baryon
hierarchy.
No. Dark matter. Okay, they are dark matter and... Well, okay. Yeah, okay.
Plus baryon.
No, of course, you know what I mean. No, you know what I mean. No, okay. You know what I mean. Wait. And say the dark matter inherited a hierarchy scenario, you know, for the baryons, and must be inverted. I'm not so, you know. And, you know, in these days, there is a very popular word that's used for the same thing, you know, which is downsizing, which is, you know, every time we do the same thing, we come up with a very fancy way. But this is, I think, this sort of data I showed should provide further constraints in trying to understand this downsizing effect. And so the summary, well, okay, so from studying not only these clusters, but other, say, redshift, 10 clusters are recognized in 0.8, and we are studying this way. We see that cluster formation was already in advanced dynamical state, if you want. There are two things that come out of the X-ray survey and X-ray data. One is something that I haven't talked about here, but, you know, it's part of the today low redshift, low density universe we think we live in, so that the cluster space density does not evolve. But not only that, the scaling relations do not evolve significantly over 60% of the look back time. We do see that the metal production must be pushed a pretty high redshift in order to explain the observation. As for the mode information on the cluster early types, we have seen that the massive early types are already there. They form already a very tight sequence, and this tight sequence remains tight for 60% of the lookback time. So all this information sort of corroborate the idea that most of the stars, the bulk of the stars, were formed between redshift 2 and 3, so pretty high redshift. And then I talk about what we seem to understand from the K-band luminosity functions. And so, for example, the fact that the merging doesn't seem to be so a key factor of these redshifts. And well, obviously, there are this issue of the downsizing that the semiotical models they need to address. Now, the future, there are Spitzer observations, which maybe I show, just show, give me the same cluster I showed before. So this is a Spitzer observation we just got in a program PI by Peter Heisenhardt, and Adam Stanford is also heavily involved in this. So we're following up all the RDCS clusters of Reshin greater than 0.7 with the aim of measuring the stellar, the evolution of the stellar mass from the K-band rest frame light. And so this is a VLT optical. Now I just switch into Spitzer IRAC. This is only 15 minutes observation with IRAC and a 3.6 micron, so J-band rest frame if you want a bit less. See that, so these are the cluster galaxy, obviously they jump up into the K correction. This is the K-band rest frame at 4.5 micron. You can do a color image, but I mean, we are now in the process of increasing, extending the spectral energy distribution thanks to this data. So this, I think, will help a lot in understanding the mass assembly, the stellar mass assembly history in these clusters. And then, well, obviously, what we need to do is to push to find form dynamically evolved clusters that are actually greater than 1.4. This day is not easy. I think probably the best shot we have these days before tonight's Adobe service will really start kicking in is to actually use very large area Spitzer surveys. You know, it's very easy to find, to single out just passive red galaxies out to redshift 2 with really like 5 minutes, 10 minutes exposure with Spitzer. So this is something that people are doing and probably will be very useful. And then, you know, something that I didn't have the time to talk about, but I think it would be very important if you're aware of all this, the work by George Malley and collaborators, where, you know, they followed up first with narrowband imaging and then spectroscopy, a large number now of radio galaxies between redshift 2 and 4. They found, you know, massive overdensity of galaxies around this. The interesting thing is there is this ubiquitous Lyman alpha halos around this very, very luminous, I mean, 10 to the 43 air per second around these clusters. And so at some point, somebody would have to try, and we try with George in a way, try to bridge the spectral energy distributions of these cluster gases in clusters are actually 1.2 with these proto clusters, with the hope of, you know, having a single track to link, you know, these progenitors to these galaxies, this brother cluster member. So this is quite interesting because, of course, we're talking about what are the progenitors of these massive cluster galaxies. And until a few years ago, especially theorists would have told you, well, they are Lyman Gray galaxies. You know, basically, there were these semi-elliptical models where, you know, Lyman Gray galaxy were put, sort of, were left there and just left, you know, and sort of put almost by hand to end up into clusters at redshift 1. I mean, they were on the knots of the last period, of the last structure, redshift 3, and then, you know, they would evolve into elliptical low redshift clusters. However, you know, this day, later on, we understood that the masses of the Lyman-Barré galaxies were perhaps overestimated because of the outflows. The metallicities are not, you know, pretty low. So if you have to bet these days, what are the progenitors of these galaxies are perhaps not really the Lyman-Barré galaxy, but are these new galaxies, new massive star-forming galaxies that have been found at redshift 2 or so, with either with color technique or just looking at the tip of the iceberg of a K-band limited survey, like K-band selected survey, like the K20. And then I encourage everyone here to work harder in going from phenomenology to a theory which is more physically motivated for an evolution of the barons. Thanks.
More questions for you.